Going West is the oldest dedicated literary festival in Aotearoa. Right from its small beginnings, it's taken pride in presenting 100% Aotearoa content. Like a lot of events around the world, COVID-19 has forced the organisers to rethink things. This year they're going online and presenting recordings of more or less everything they've ever done. And that's where we come in. Because starting tonight, for the next 6 weeks, we'll be playing some of that content right here on RNZ National Nights. And joining me now is the festival's producer, James Littlewood. Kia ora, James.
Kia ora, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks very much for this wonderful material. When did the festival start? I said earlier 1996. Was that right?
Yes. That's when it all kicked off. We wouldn't be here without Murray Gray and Naomi McCleary. Murray owned a bookshop in Parnell, and Naomi was an arts manager at Waitakere Council. She walked into his bookshop and said, well, why don't we put Morris G on a train and go west? And here we go west. That's pretty much what happened.
Yeah, I was going to ask you whether the Going West title was a coincidence, given that it's the name of a book that Morris G wrote. In fact, a lot of his books are set in this fantasy town that's based on a West Auckland suburb, Loomis.
Loomis, that's right. Which, I mean, so much else in that book is a direct, explicit reference to Henderson and Auckland and Newmarket and places. You sometimes wonder why he bothered changing the name at all. Anyway, but I'm sure other people know more about that than I do. But Henderson's dear to our heart. The West is dear to our heart, and well, Naomi, of course, was the arts manager in Waitakere Council, so we flourished in those pre-amalgamation days all over West Auckland. Yeah.
Who recorded? Because we've been listening to the stuff and thinking, whoever did it was a really good engineer. Who was that engineer?
His name's Dave Hodge. And in the early days, back in 1996, they all got on a train, in the old railway, that magnificent old railway building designed by Gummer. They'd get on it. I think they brought the train in from the Coonie Mile Railway or something, a steam train, and they'd jump on this train, because in those days, the Western Line wasn't quite so busy as it is these days.
Nah.
And they'd stop off and they'd have literary encounters. And I think at one of the stops they got off at what's now called Corbin's Estate, the old Corbin's Winery, which is now also owned by Auckland Council, but was purchased by Waitakere Council. And Dave Hodge turned up with some amp and speakers, and happened to mention to Naomi that he had recorded it, and on some decent quality tape, and those recording assets stayed under Naomi's desk for a little while until one Robin Mason found them. Robin's now our archivist, but back then she worked for Henderson Library. And she was like, God, we've got to get these things. And so Henderson Library and, since amalgamation, Auckland Libraries have been archiving this stuff and also very generously supporting the recording of it. Which is really fabulous. It's a truly outstanding archive. I mean, we can only publish it. We'd love to publish all of it. It's quite a task, but it's all held in Auckland Libraries now. If you like what we've got for you and the listeners on Radio New Zealand, then we've got even more on our website, and there's still more at Auckland Libraries. Tons.
James, it's lovely to talk to you. Good luck for this year's festival. Just briefly, James, because we've got to squeeze, when is the festival kicking off online?
Oh, we're online now. We've been podcasting from our archives, and we've got a lot of new content that'll be coming online soon, which will be newly commissioned works made. We'll be working a lot with video. Yeah, it's going to be really exciting. We're moving into a whole new era.
Thanks so much, James. Good night.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Enjoy the show.
Thanks, James. That's James Littlewood. He's the producer of the Going West Literary and Arts Festival in West Auckland. So let's begin our series now. Best of the West. We're going back to 2001 for a performance involving a couple of poets called Working Class Heroes. Those poets, Siri Bardfoot and Glenn Cahoon, celebrate their working class roots on the Going West Oblivion Express. Just a little warning, there's some pretty saucy language in this number.
Hello. We're going to do a tandem act here. My collection is called Westy File, and I wrote it because I felt that the working class is underrepresented in poetry. It's very hard to find, working class experiences on the shelves in poetry. And so I thought, well, stuff this. And so here we go. I've taken the perspective of a Tusitala, which is Samoan for storyteller. My mother is German Samoan. And I thought I'd start with a poem, and it's called Post-World War II Suburbs, just setting the scene of people pouring into West Auckland. Heroic nationalism gave way to nuclear families, cloned houses, avenues devoid of trees. Heroes, no longer fighting for king and country, slogged for wages, a personal plot of subdivided utopia. Concrete driveways with a mowing strip, an erection of boundary fences, telegraph poles with highly strung wires linking families to the main line. Something for kids to hide behind, birds to perch on, dogs to lift a leg against, fibre-lightened wood, brick and tile boxes we called home. How the West filled up. Dreams and baggage from Europe, the Balkans, the Middle East. How we poured in. Māori moving to town, Polynesian labourers, Asians with vegetables, men with blue collars and rugby balls, women with cardigans and aprons to protect them from cold wars, fallout, ornamental ducks flying up walls, past mirrors over fireplaces, reflecting wrought iron magazine racks, formica bench tops, white swan vases, swimming glass, coffee tables, stuffed with bird of paradise leaves and flowers, tropically brilliant to complement African faces hanging in the wall, just two, him facing her. I never knew their names, though I often ran the narrow passage at night to the biggest bowl in the house, left unflushed till morning, lest it woke whoever was sleeping in the end room next to the neighbours we borrowed cups of sugar from for cakes, bulking out school lunches jammed into bread bags on the way out of the Pride and Joy new front door, a glass stag flinging his antlers towards the recently tar-sealed road, black perambulators rolled over on their way to the post office for the family benefit, buying shoes on lay-by, fish and chips on Friday, a supply of taro and green bananas and coconut cream for my homesick mum.
Kia ora everyone, that's a hard act to follow. I'm going to read you a poem that's sort of in a similar vein, but I'm a South Auckland boy, so I think today, I think today I've been talking to Cherie in the car, and it sounds like really South Auckland and West Auckland have lots and lots of things in common. So today I'm an adopted West Aucklander. So I'll change the title of the poem for you. I think our suburbs, South Auckland and West Auckland, in some ways are Cinderellas, which always makes me feel quite good, because I've always thought of the North Shore and Central Auckland as the ugly sisters anyway. So for this poem was called Bred in South Auckland, but I think I'll call it Bred in West Auckland. I drive a car that is falling apart. There is bog in the body. There is rust in the doors. Occasionally, it does not have a warrant. Sometimes I sleep in large rooms full of people. I eat too much fried bread. I am late to meetings. I go to housey. My nose is flat. I say Rotorua. Some people think I am a bloody Maori. I have been to university. I have a student loan. I photocopy my tax returns. Most mornings I read the newspaper. I make lists of things I have to do and like to cross them off. I cut apples into quarters before I eat them. Then I cut the pips out. I put my name on things. I listen to talkback radio. I use FPOS. Some people think I am a typical Pākehā. Last week I drove through a red light. I did not slow down at a compulsory stop. I changed lanes on the motorway and did not use my indicator. When I was a boy, I went to see Enter the Dragon. I took one lesson in Kung Fu. My parents made me do my homework. My brother gave me Chinese burns. I like beef and pork-flavoured two-minute noodles. I light incense when the house smells once. I dug a garden. Some people think I am a blasted Asian. When I was a boy, I learnt to swear in Samoan. I went to school in Māngere. I played rugby in bare feet. Sometimes I shop at the Ōtara markets. My family come from overseas. I used to work in a factory. Once I helped to cook an umu. When it is summer, I wear a lava-lava. I drink pineapple juice. I like to eat corned beef. Some people think I must be a flaming coconut. I think I'm the luckiest mongrel I know.
Well, some of you are looking pretty happy on the wine, and this poem is called Heard It on the Grapevine. I used to go picking grapes with some of my Corbin friends. We used to get on the back of an old truck and go and get the grapes. And this is called Heard It on the Grapevine. For the colour of my eyes, I wore two strings of beads, celestial blue, painstakingly thread the day Lennon died to ward off evil. An Arabic custom, my friend said. Grapes and gossip cluttering vines raised on a low sulphur regime. Glassy ripe, inverted pyramids gently fell into a back-breaking day. Family secrets kept us going. What Francesca wore when she met Ben. How Zealandia couldn't stop biting her nails. The alchemy of Usud's orchids. Lamenting Ruby's lemons, too bitter for Tabuli this year. All the while, an elderly man, almost blind, picked faster than we did, his hands tracing vines like women smooth singlets over the kidneys of small, beloved children to ward off chills.
This poem was actually is a poem I've stolen from a conversation I had with someone up in Northland, but I'm sure I could have had this consultation in West Auckland as well. I was talking to a group of people about a problem in medicine, and there was an old queer up the back of the hall that I was talking to. I was talking about iron deficiency anemia, which is very boring, so I won't go on about it. But this old lady took this as an excuse to talk about, ask any question about medicine. She stood up at the back of the hall, and the poem comes from that. She said to me, "Boy," and as soon as she said "boy," I knew I was in big trouble. She said, "Boy, I've got a question for you." And the question is the title of the poem, and then the poem is sort of my feeble attempts at answering. It's a medicine poem. She asked me if she took one pill for her heart and one pill for her hips and one pill for her chest and one pill for her blood, how come they would all know which part of her body they should go to? I explained to her that active metabolites in each pharmaceutical would adopt a spatial configuration leading to an exact interface with the receptor molecules on the cellular surfaces of the target structures involved. She told me not to bullshit her. I told her that each pill had a different shape and that each part of her body had a different shape. and that her pills could only work when both these shapes could fit together. She said I had no right to talk about the shape of her body. I said that each pill was a key and that her body was 10,000 locks. She said she wasn't going to swallow that. I told her that they worked by magic. She asked me why I didn't say that in the first place.
This is a sequence of poems and it's called Childhood Revisited. I grrew up in the Te Aritu Peninsula. It was pretty rural in the 1950s and 1960s. It wasn't tar sealed. There was a Hungarian Jew, Mr. Nagel, and his son still runs the factory called Nagel's or Nagel's Creation by the gin factory where my mother used to work, Seeger's. And in those days, well, my father worked making lingerie. He used to really embarrass me. We'd go into Farmers in Hobson Street on a Friday night and he'd go straight to the ladies' underwear section and pick up the underwear and put his hands through the crotch like this, testing the elastic and the lace and everything. I used to be totally humiliated by him. Yeah. Anyway, in those days, women could actually be out workers. That's a lot more than it is now, and you worked at home. And Mr. Nagel was one of the first people out west, perhaps, I could be wrong here, to actually provide a creche for the workers. And his people laughed at him because the creche was as big as the factory. Yeah. And we all decided that maybe he'd lost a lot of family in the Holocaust and maybe family was important to him and maybe that's why he built the creche. And he said, no, women work better when the children are close by. Yeah. So, poem for an out worker. Yeah, he's ahead of his time. Evenings were full of lace supplied by a local factory with a plank of wood cut to a yard and a nail marking the severing point. Snip, snip, mum sheared lace for petticoats, pus oozing from thumbnails the doctor couldn't fix. A kind of fungus, he said. Keep away from detergent. Mum nodded, bought rubber gloves, dropped a glass a day. When mum went out, she painted red over everything. Nagel's lingerie. You're allowed to advertise lingerie as long as the models look like statues. That was the rule of the time. A bit different than now. Dad worked days at the lingerie factory, nights, Saturdays too. On Sundays, he helped Mum slip metal clips onto shoulder straps, threepence a bundle for the mortgage. Women adjusted the clips, hoisted, lowered their petticoats to suit hems and occasions. Those days, lingerie models didn't move on television. Like a statue, they smiled, invited you to buy. I used to be really jealous of this little girl who only had one dress, and I mean, that's all she had, one dress, but I just thought it was so pretty. And looking back, you know, in retrospect, you realise actually that it was poverty. This is called Susie's Dress. And also around about this time, a lot of people I knew had rheumatic fever, some of my cousins and some of my neighbours. And this was written, as they say, in retrospect, Susie's Dress. Susie wore a red party frock, summer and winter, to school. I thought it was beautiful. Lamented my hand-me-downs and mum sewing on the Singer treadle anchored by the back window overlooking the backyard. When cousin Patricia, despite a tricky heart, outgrew her lace petticoat, I bundled it to school, where I transformed into a princess in the girls' toilets. Susie and I played marbles for keeps with a different Patricia from Huntley, who had a sister called Queenie and lived with her granny next to the Four Square. After school, we walked home, hand in hand, past the factories, waving to Dad drinking tea in the lunchroom. When Patricia from school got rheumatic fever, I sent her a get-well card then renamed my doll Patrick in order to protect her heart. I played Bull Rush with Black Power. I felt quite safe where I grew up. I knew there were always people to look out for me, even though I was a bit of a wimp and skinny and not so good at sports and things. Bull Rush. My club congregated at the Green Transformer. Lightning blew up one day. We delighted in the live wire signs, the possibility of burnt knickers, the way the street was ours. One afternoon, my sister smashed her head playing Bull Rush at its best. I thought she was a goner. Punched her until her eyes came back from behind her fringe. She wobbled to her knees. Everyone cheered. David tagged her. You're in. And the final one for the sequence. David actually had meningitis. We had an outbreak of meningitis in my neighbourhood. And he had brain damage after this. And he used to do all these sorts of things. We used to rush home from school. Our mothers would make us read our journals. And then we'd go outside and watch David and his dog doing all these sorts of things, which later I realised that's what you put nanny minder on your internet for, to stop kids getting into that. And this is just what we used to see. Anyway, David's place. When Black Power filled the kitchen at David's place, we squatted on the road watching them sing. Candles on the table captured his mother's laughter. Her handwriting was as beautiful as her face. When she wrote lists for the dairy, we took turns stroking the paper.
I'm going to read a poem, another poem that I stole, really. I tend to steal poems off people. I don't know if I'm a real writer or I just copy things down. This poem came from my auntie, who kept leaving messages on my answer phone. And they are such fantastic messages. Each one was a short oral poem, I thought. And so I kept them, and then Telecom rang me and said, you've got to wipe some of the messages because we can't leave any new messages on your phone. So I copied them all down and turned them into a poem. It's called Messages Received Loud and Clear. My auntie didn't know. It took her a while to get used to the answer phone. To begin with, it's the first time she'd ever heard of such a thing. Anyway, it goes like this. Message received Friday, February the 9th at 7:12 p.m. Oi! Boy! Are you there? I don't know if he's there. Someone's there. Gee, I don't know what to do with this thing, man. Are you there, boy? Maybe someone knocked on the door. Boy. Boy. Boy! It's your queer here. Hurry up. Hey, what do I do with this phone, man? I think this phone is broken. Fix your phone, man. Message received Wednesday, February the 14th at 6:21 p.m. Gee! Hoha! Boy, I don't want to talk to this thing. Call me back. Did you hear me? Boy! Heck! Message received Thursday, February the 15th at 4:27 p.m. Boy! Tenakwe, boy! Gee, what a thing! Bye! Ka kite. See you later. Message received Sunday, February the 18th at 2:29 p.m. Boy, kia ora, boy. Kei hea koe e koro. Where are you, boy? Love you. Message received Friday, February the 23rd at 3:35 p.m. Bloody hell. Where the bloody hell you been? Kua kite koe he wahine mau. Have you found a woman for yourself? Gee. Big bait, big fish, man. Little bait, little fish. Ka pai ne. Bet they're not as good looking as me. Laughing. More laughing. Laughing. Noises that can't be spelt. Laughing. Ka kite. Message received Thursday, March the 1st at 10:53 a.m. Ai, Maraka, you're never home. Ka hoki mai koe, ka ringi mai ai, ne? When you get home, give me a call. Kia ora. Big bait, big fish, ne? Ka, bye. Message received Monday, March the 5th at 9:42 a.m. Gee, darling, I can't make it. Sorry. If you come, I won't be here. I have to go out. There's a kai in the fridge. Make sure you do the dishes. I won't be here because I'm going out. Mind your own bloody business. Message received Tuesday, March the 6th at 6:54 p.m. Boy, ko peki hoha tēnei. Bye. Pehe ana koe, how are you? Moki moki ana koe, are you lonely? Ka kite, boy. Message received Friday, February the 9th at 5:45 p.m. Kia ora, boy. I just got back from the hospital. All right. Ka nui taku tino ora e koro. I'm really well. Good report. Lovely. Energetic. Ready to fight. All right. Ka kite. Gee, I love your phone, man. And another poem about another auntie who I try and write serious poetry, but halfway along I got all these voices around me that sort of hijacked the poem. But this is one poem I wrote for my auntie who passed away a couple of years ago. And I had a really neat friendship with her, one of the great friendships of my life, really. And I guess one of the things I learned is that when someone passes away, they don't always leave you. And in many ways, they stay with us. And so this is a poem for Auntie Rongo, and it's called There Are No Days Without You. There are no days without you. On Sunday I sleep late. The morning is barefooted. Old women wear large hats outside the front doors of churches. Inside I hear the sound of singing. On Monday the tide goes out. Later, it returns. The beach looks like a wide mouth chewing bread. At times, we hold conversations. On Tuesday, the moon appears in the afternoon like a ghost. A ball kicked over the fence by small neighbours. I see their round eyes staring at me. On Wednesday, I watch a narrow boat leave for fishing. One fern of grey water following. I think of soft plaits in long hair. On Thursday I catch the bus into town. The man beside me turns over the pages of his newspaper. I consider the delicacy of skin. On Friday I decide to go shopping. I wait in a long line at a counter to buy groceries and recognize the small bones that queue along the back of your spine. On Saturday, I rise early and walk down to the sea. A row of seagulls argue in the breeze. One leaf falls against my path as though it was carefully planned. There are no days without you.
Is for Muruwai and the Gannet colony, and the idea I had is that a lot of New Zealanders leave and go to Australia, and so do the Gannets, and sometimes they come back and sometimes they don't. And it's for my cousin Patricia, the one that had rheumatic fever, and she actually died last year. Migration. At the edge of the wind, lava has cooled to glassy black cliffs. lending scant comfort to dune grasses struggling for permanence on humps of sand, momentarily bound by flimsy, trailing roots, exposed by currents, both wind and surf, to gannets nesting on the headland, their naked chicks clamouring blindly for fish, their white wings trimmed with black, their amber heads beacons to stragglers homing in at dusk, and juveniles testing their heads for heights before heading for Australian waters. Which reminds me of you, Patricia, my childhood cousin, newly dead, from a heart that couldn't take the swirled, like you took yellow felt, sewed slippers for our dolls, bright as any crayoned childish sun, till rheumatic fever dimmed your ringlets. Still curling at 17 when you married, belly tight with child, a gold band on one hand, ciggy in the other. Such frail shoulders, I wondered how you could bear anything. Then one season, you crossed the Tasman with the gannets. Last I heard, you were going down, losing your sight, making a fist at living, writing poetry, blotting out the grey.
I'm just going to sort of, I guess there's been a tiny thread of a medical theme there. There's some rheumatic fever and meningitis. So I use that excuse to read a couple of spells from medicine. I've been working for the last few years on a collection of poems about medicine. And for those of you who don't know, I work as a doctor. And it's a fascinating place to draw stories from, and it's also got this whole language to plunder that has really been plundered. And if you just enjoy language, it's good fun to play with some of the forms you find in medicine. But what I wanted to do was write some spells about medicine. Medicine's got a grand history of the dark arts and karakia and things like that. And I think still there's much art in medicine, like it or not. And so I wanted to write some spells, and I'm going to read two short spells, one about being born and one about dying. And this first spell, I was talking to one of the aunties up north who was a midwife, and she would tell me about when babies were born, how they would karanga the baby as it came through the birth canal. And so I thought that was a neat idea, and I worked as a paediatric house surgeon, and we used to stand in the corner of the room and receive the babies once it had been born. We kept away from where it was messy and wet, and got the baby and made it cry, basically, which was one of the best jobs I ever had. So a spell to be used when addressing the birth of a child. Let your first breath be the volume of small lemons. Let your second breath snap like a sail in strong wind. Let your third breath howl like a wolf at the edge of a great mountain. Let your fourth breath hoot like an owl. Let your fifth breath open slowly like the eye of a wild animal. Let your sixth breath rise like the sun. Let your seventh breath follow the tide on its way out. Let your eighth breath guide it back in. And the last poem is just a recent poem I wrote to sort of match that poem. I'm working in Waikato Hospital now in the intensive care department. Part of our job is to go to lots of cardiac arrests, which, because they don't happen on television, are not very successful. I wanted to write... I thought nothing else was working, so I might write a spell to use at the next cardiac arrest I go to. Maybe it's because I spend too much time writing poetry, not enough studying, that my cardiac arrests don't seem to go too successfully. You'll be reassured to know that a couple of nights back I read this to all the nurses working in the intensive care unit, and they looked at each other and go, "What the fuck are you talking about?" So at least they know what they're really doing. So this is a spell to be used in the event of a cardiac arrest. It's called When the Heart Stops Beating. When the heart stops beating, call to the ember in the fire growing dull. Call to the plain girl not dancing. Call to the fish at the end of its line. Call to the soldier not marching. Call to the bird singing weak in the tree. Call to the broomstick not sweeping. Call to the child still awake in the dark, and call for the child still sleeping.
Recorded in 2001 on Helensville Poets, Glenn Colquhoun and Siri Barford, kicking off our series of some of the best of Auckland's Going West Festival.